Welcome to FedSoc Forums, a podcast of the Federal Society's Practice Groups. I'm Nate Kazmarek, Vice President and Director of Practice Groups at the Federal Society. For exclusive access to live recordings of FedSoc Forum programs, become a Federal Society member today at fedsoc.org.
Hello and welcome to this FedSoc Forum webinar call. Today, January 21st, 2026, we're delighted to host a Courthouse Steps decision program on Barrett versus United States, which was decided last week by the court. My name is Kayla Kleist, and I'm Deputy Director of Practice Groups here at the Federalist Society. As always, please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the expert on today's program, as the Federalist Society takes no position on particular legal or public policy issues. Now, in the interest of time, I will keep my introduction of our guest today brief, certainly more brief than his career would deserve. So I highly recommend that if you're interested, you check out his impressive full bio at fedsoc.org. Today, we're fortunate to have with us William McClintock, who is a partner at King & Spalding's Washington, D.C. office and a member of the firm's Special Matters and Government Investigations practice. He focuses his practice on government investigations, internal investigations, voluntary self-disclosures, and white-collar criminal defense. He's experienced representing companies and individuals in investigations conducted by federal and state authorities, including the Department of Justice, multiple United States attorneys' offices, and multiple investigative committees of the United States Congress. And I'll leave it there. A last note before I get off your screens and we head into a time of opening remarks. If you have any questions, please do submit them via the question and answer feature, likely found at the bottom of your Zoom screen, so they'll be accessible when we get to that extended portion of today's webinar. I'll ask that all questions submitted there, A, pertain to this discussion, and B, end with a question mark. With that, thank you all for joining us today. Mr. McClintock, the floor is yours.
Thank you very much, and thank you to the Federalist Society for the opportunity to speak today about the Barrett decision. I know that folks are focused on things at the Supreme Court, like the impending IEEPA tariff decision, the arguments today about the removal of Federal Reserve governors, but I am grateful to see so many folks that are interested, like I am, in this interesting criminal law decision that touches on things like sentencing, at least incidentally, on the Double Jeopardy Clause. I think it tells us some interesting things about how the court methodologically is approaching statutory construction cases, sentencing cases, and so appreciate the opportunity to talk with all of you all today and hopefully answer any questions. As noted at the beginning, any opinions and certainly any mistakes or errors are solely mine and not those of the Federalist Society or King & Spalding, and also nothing that I share today should be construed as legal advice or creating an attorney-client relationship. And with that, we'll jump right in. What we're talking about today is the courthouse decision forum for Barrett versus United States, number 245774, which was argued in early October of this year, and a decision came down last week on January 14th. And this is an interesting decision dealing with 18 U.S.C. 924C. We'll get into sort of how the holding broke down. It's a per curiam opinion of the court drafted by Justice Jackson. There were no dissenting opinions, but we do have a portion of the opinion that only had four justices join on dealing with legislative history and a concurrence from Justice Gorsuch. And so we will get into all of those opinions. But to start, I think it's probably helpful to level set and talk about the statute at issue. This is a statute, 18 U.S.C. 924, which has generated a lot of Supreme Court litigation and decisions over the last several years. And it's fairly complex, so it's probably helpful to step back and talk about the statute and how it's structured as applicable to the Barrett case before we get into the procedural background, the facts, or the court's reasoning and holding. So 18 U.S.C. 924C was originally passed in 1968, and it's a statute that makes it a discrete crime to use or carry a firearm in connection with other federal crimes of violence or drug trafficking offenses. So like many other federal statutes, it requires predicate offenses and then establishes a new offense for the use of the carrying or use of a gun in connection with those predicate offenses. the key provision at issue in the Barrett case is 924C1A subpart 1, which provides that anyone who uses or carries a firearm in connection with a crime of violence or a drug trafficking offense, or otherwise possesses a firearm in furtherance of the offense, will receive a 5-year mandatory minimum in addition to the punishment for any other offense. So for 924C, Congress has made clear through amendments that a subsection C violation is an additional offense to the underlying predicate offense. It does not displace the predicate offense. And amendments establish that the sentences both for the 924C violation and the predicate offense should run consecutively rather than concurrently. Importantly, 924C imposes mandatory minimums for a variety of different provisions. So it'll be important because another provision at issue applies maximums, but not mandatory minimums. But 924C is noteworthy in establishing mandatory minimum sentences for violations. In 1994, also relevant to this case, Congress passed another provision of 924. So this is 924J, also relevant here, which created a different penalty scheme for 924C violations that cause death. And so it's got two subparts, but the structure of 924J is that a person who, in the course of violating subsection C, which we just talked about, causes the death of a person through the use of a firearm, shall, if the killing is a murder as defined in federal criminal law, then the death penalty is eligible, or by imprisonment or imprisonment. And if it's manslaughter, then to be punished as provided in the federal manslaughter section. So importantly, 924J creates much higher maximum sentences, and if it's a murder, allows for capital punishment. It's not particularly relevant here, but 924J also expands the jurisdiction of the federal government to seek death penalty cases and murders more broadly geographically. So this was a tool that Congress gave the federal government in the 1990s that sort of heightened penalties for gun offenses that lead to death. So we've got these two 924 provisions with different sentencing schemes, but cover largely the same elements, with the exception that 924J also requires death. So for procedural background, in 2011 and 2012, Dwayne Barrett, the defendant and petitioner in this case, participated in a string of robberies. And during one of those robberies, an accomplice shot and killed a victim named Gamar Defala. Mr. Barrett was convicted on 7 charges, but 3 matter for our purposes. For those who are following along with the opinion, count 5 was the predicate offense, the underlying offense that we talked about. And so that was the Hobbs Act robbery of Mr. Defala, the person who died. And so that was an 18 U.S.C. 1951 violation. So that's the predicate offense. Count 6 is the original 924C1 offense, using a firearm during the commission of the Hobbs Act robbery. Count 7 is the 924J violation, because Mr. Defala died during the Hobbs Act robbery and a gun was used. He's therefore charged under subpart J with the maximum sentence. He's convicted on all 7 charges at the original trial. He is sentenced to 90 years in prison. There's a long back and forth appellate history. As criminal practitioners and members of the Federalist Society will know, there's been a lot of decisions on 924C. So Mr. Barrett has availed himself of those. As part of that appellate process, a 924C conviction that had nothing to do with the counts at issue in last week's opinion was kicked out. And so his sentence went down from 90 years to 50 years. Importantly, for our discussion, 20 of those 50 were for the Hobbs Act predicate offense, and then 25 were for counts 6 and 7, and the court in that sentence had merged counts 6 and 7, so the 924C and the 924J counts together. On a subsequent appeal, however, The Second Circuit, and this is fairly complicated and we won't get into it here, the Second Circuit held that the C and J violations were separate offenses for which Congress had clearly authorized cumulative concurrent sentences and offenses, and instructed the district court to impose separate convictions and sentences on counts 6 and 7. So the Second Circuit said, nope, these are two separate offenses, and the statutory scheme expects consecutive sentences, and so instructed the district court to sentence as such. This contributed to an ongoing circuit split. So the Second Circuit's approach aligned with the 11th Circuit, but conflicted with the 1st, 4th, and 5th Circuits. Interestingly, the government and Mr. Barrett were aligned and did not agree with the Second Circuit appeal, or the Second Circuit Court of Appeals decision. So the Supreme Court granted cert, but because the government agreed with Mr. Barrett, the court appointed an amicus to defend the Second Circuit's judgment below. So on appeal to the Supreme Court, the key question presented is whether a single act, that is the robbery that led to Mr. DeFalla's death, that violates both 924C1 and 924J, may produce two convictions or only one. And sort of the corollary to that is, if it can produce two convictions, can it produce two consecutive sentences such that the defendant serves time for one act in two consecutive sentences? I think in the court's opinion, Justice Jackson framed it helpfully that the court had clearly established in prior hearings that the predicate offense, so that's the Hobbs Act robbery, and the 924C offense are separate convictions and consecutive sentences. So that is resolved. The question is about the two 924 provision violations. And so the way Justice Jackson framed it is, does 924J, which penalizes for violations that lead to death, does that throw a third level of punishment on top, in effect allowing three stacked convictions or punishments? So that would be counts 5, 6, and 7 for Mr. Barrett. Do you get the sort of predicate offense, Hobbs Act violation, and get a sentence? Then you get the 924C violation for using a gun and get a consecutive mandatory minimum. And then because the victim died, do you therefore have a third consecutive sentence that comes under J with a maximum? The court, to summarize very briefly, said that between the two 924 counts, only one conviction is allowed. Congress did not clearly authorize cumulative convictions for the same act under 924C and 924J. So the court reversed the Second Circuit in part and remanded. So as I mentioned before, this is an interesting sort of structure of the opinions. We have a per curiam opinion drafted by Justice Jackson. And so parts 1 through 4B are joined by the court. And then part 4C is a four-justice opinion in which Justice Jackson, Justice Sotomayor, Justice Kagan, and the Chief Justice join and address the role that legislative history played in reaching their decision. So only four justices join, so that's not a majority of the court. And then Justice Gorsuch concurred in part, did not join part 4C, and then wrote a concurrence about his views of the role the Double Jeopardy Clause plays in reaching his decision. So let's start with a per curiam opinion. Although the Mr. Barrett appeal was framed as a double jeopardy concern, in effect, his argument was that if you serve two consecutive sentences for the very same conduct, then it presents double jeopardy concerns. The court avoided reaching the double jeopardy clause consideration here and rather treated the issue as one of congressional authorization. So the first inquiry being, what punishments did Congress intend to allow when drafting and enacting these two provisions, 924C? And 924J. So before even reaching the Fifth Amendment, the court needed to decide if Congress intended for them to be multiple convictions and multiple punishments. The court concluded that Congress did not intend for them to be multiple convictions for the same conduct. The court applied a very textualist analysis, but also implied a longstanding presumption that it had created in the Blockberger case. And so the Blockberger presumption is that if two statutes define the same offense, then Congress is presumed not to have authorized cumulative convictions or punishments absent a clear statement of their intent to do so. The Blockberger presumption defines the same offense. So two provisions define the same offense if each does not require proof of a fact that the other does. And so sort of step back. Let's say you've got two provisions and there's an inquiry like, do these provisions define the same offense? The court's inquiry under Blockberger does each of these have an element that the other does not? And so if they don't, then they are the same offense. And so if they are the same offense, then there is a presumption that Congress did not authorize cumulative punishments if triggered. So here, the entire court agreed, and the Second Circuit below agreed, I believe, that they were that the 924C and 924J are defining the same offense. They define the same offense because 924J is a greater offense of 924C, which is simply a lesser included offense. The only thing that 924J is in fact defined as a 924C violation that leads to death, and if it's a murder, then the death penalty is authorized. So the court reaches that point and they conclude that the Blockberger presumption is triggered, meaning that Congress is presumed not to have authorized cumulative punishments. The presumption can be overcome, however, by a clear statement from Congress that they meant to authorize multiple convictions. So at this point, the court's opinion turned to the text and the structure of the statute, and then Justice Jackson, in her four-justice opinion, turned to legislative history. Starting with the textual analysis, the court pointed to the fact that Congress knows how to authorize cumulative punishments when it wants to, and in fact has done that in 924C. So 924C1 says that a 924C conviction is in addition to the punishment for the predicate offense. There are other 924C provisions that also use that in addition to language. And the court has interpreted that in addition to language to say that in addition to the predicate offense, the 924C punishment is a separate offense and a separate sentence. The 924C consecutive sentencing mandate, however, the court noted, is not enough to show that they are separate convictions, because there is another 924C provision, 1D subpart 2, that requires consecutive sentences when there are two valid convictions, but does not itself authorize, but the court said that that does not itself authorize two convictions. So first you have to determine whether two convictions are permitted, and then only then do you apply the consecutive sentencing rule. So the court looked at it and said 924C says that you do in addition to consecutive sentences as against the predicate offense, but 924J does not include that language. And so the court does not read that as permitting the triple stacking that Justice Jackson framed it up as. The amicus who argued on behalf of the Second Circuit raised a second textualist, or I'll say quasi-textualist argument, stating that 924C and 924J, although they have similar elements, they have different focuses. And so 924C is focused on the use of firearms, and 924J focuses on death. The court did not accept that argument and said that just because they have different focuses does not, that's very common with greater and lesser included offenses and doesn't overcome the Blockberger presumption or permit stacking. Taking it one step further, the court-appointed amicus made a structural and operational argument. There's a couple of these, but I think the most important for purposes of this call is that amicus argued that because C imposed mandatory minimums and 924J did not and focused on sentencing maximums, that the Congress must have intended for them to work together as cumulative convictions. Otherwise, prosecutors who chose to proceed under 924J rather than C could end up in a perverse situation where they achieve a conviction under 924J, which is a greater offense than 924C, but the sentencing court would not be bound by 924C's mandatory minimums. So the hypothetical is that the Department of Justice chooses to pursue a 924J, which is a greater offense and leads to death. The jury convicts, and then the court on sentencing is faced with a mandatory or high maximum, but does not in fact have the mandatory minimum of 924C. And depending on your sentencing judge, you could have the judge sentence below the mandatory minimum. So the amicus said that doesn't make sense given the structure of the statute. The court rejected that argument and described it as what it perceived as more of a theoretical risk rather than a real risk. Court noted that judges are bound by 18 U.S.C. 3553, in which they have to recognize the seriousness of the offense, and that recognizing that it was a death offense, that they expected judges to sort of understand the seriousness of a 924J offense. And they also noted that sometimes prosecutors are forced with a choice, and that where overlapping offenses share elements but have separate self-contained penalty schemes, Congress is presumed to have offered a charging alternative rather than cumulative punishments. And so recognizing that they have different penalty schemes, prosecutors would just have to choose going forward between 924C and its mandatory minimums and 924J for its high-end flexibility, but would not sort of be able to avail themselves of both. In the next section, this is part 4C of the opinion. This is the section that only four justices joined. It's not a particularly momentous opinion, but the opinion noted that the legislative history is relatively sparse but consistent, that contemporary descriptions in the mid-90s when 924J was being considered treated it as making a pre-existing 924C homicide a capital eligible offense, not as creating a new stackable offense, and that there was really an absence of any congressional debate authorizing cumulative punishments, and therefore the Blockburger presumption continued to govern in this decision. So the court held that Congress did not clearly authorize dual convictions under 924C and 924J for the same act, and therefore only one conviction may result when a single act violates both provisions. The court noted, and I think it's probably a reflection of the fact that there have been many, many 924 decisions in recent years, that the court's holding is expressly limited to 924C1A subpart 1 as the base 924C offense, and did not decide how the analysis might apply to other 924C variants. So if you look at the long list of 924C variants, they've all got, some of them have different, slightly different variations, slightly different language. So the court was careful that it was not making sort of a blanket holding, but was focused on this particular provision, and reversed in part and remanded to impose convictions and sentencing in accordance with its opinion. I think we should take a step here, and then we'll step back and look more broadly at practical implications and what it tells us about this court. But I think we should not give short shrift to Justice Gorsuch's concurrence. And at a very high level, Justice Gorsuch, I think, was much more willing to reach the double jeopardy question and willing to consider a more blanket rule about concurrent or consecutive offenses when it's the sentences when it's the same offense. And so his observation, which is well taken, is that if the government had charged Mr. Barrett with 924C, convicted him at trial, and then come back and charged him with 924J at a subsequent trial, it would have been an easy decision that the double jeopardy clause was implicated. And therefore, his observation that since they were brought at the same time, it's curious that the analysis is different and that the Blockberger presumption is applied. And so what he reached, what he suggested without sort of saying how he would have fallen on it, is that the court could consider making a more blanket rule regardless of whether the prosecutions for the same offense are concurrent or consecutive. At least suggested that he would be open to a more bright line rule given the double jeopardy concerns. Stepping back, I think the practical implications from this opinion is on the government side is that it will impact charging strategy. So prosecutors dealing with 924C offenses where a gun is used and that leads to death will going forward are going to have to choose between 924C and 924J when a single act satisfies both, because they're not going to be able to stack both convictions. They can opt for C to secure the mandatory minimums or pursue, I suspect that proving the element of death is not going to be the hardest part of trial. Or they can pursue a 924J violation to access the capital punishment or the higher sentencing maximums. I think on the defense side, it's the counterpoint. The counsel should be looking out for and challenging duplicative 924C and 924J counts. Because the court only authorizes one of them. Stepping back sort of methodologically, I think there are some interesting observations about the opinion. The first being that this is a per curiam opinion, and it's interesting how this court is sort of unanimously engaged in sort of textualism, sort of looking very carefully at the clauses in the statute to determine which are cumulative and which are consecutive. I recognize that the Blockberger presumption is applied to the textualist analysis, but this is a very textualist opinion drafted by a justice who is often considered part of the left bloc of the court. I think it's also interesting that we see the sort of traditional breakdown on legislative history. The conservative justices on the court do not join in the opinion on legislative history, with the exception of the Chief Justice. The other interesting piece is the court's willingness to resolve this on statutory grounds rather than reaching the double jeopardy question. Perhaps that was to sort of reach a more unanimous opinion, and perhaps it was just a desire to resolve it at the simplest level possible at statute rather than reaching a constitutional decision. And then I think Justice Gorsuch's concurrence is classic Justice Gorsuch. His willingness to engage more in the constitutional analysis, his desire often characterized as sort of looking out to avoid government overreach and sort of seeing the double jeopardy concerns, I think is very consistent with his methodology and approach on the court. I think this is a very great sort of case study showing sort of trends and methodological approaches of this court, the predominance of textualism, the fact that legislative history is still largely rejected by the conservative wing of the court, and Justice Gorsuch's, for lack of a civil libertarian streak as an originalist, are all sort of highlighted well in this opinion. With that, I will end my summary at the 30-minute mark. I'm happy to answer any questions that others might raise. And if not, I'm happy to let folks get back to their day on this cold Saturday or cold January day.
Well, thank you so much for that summary of the case and then the decision and how we've gotten to where we are. I really appreciate it. I will issue a reminder to our audience that if you've got a question, now would be the time to submit it in the Q&A box. And while we give people a minute or two to get those in, I'd love to pose a couple of my own. Typically, this is where I would start with like particular questions about the decisions and like the various opinions. Fairly straightforward. You got a 9-0 with a little bit of an asterisk on that, but a 9-0. And they're very clear about the court is addressing, what they're not addressing, and just Gorsuch is very clear as to the point of his concurrence. So I'll instead ask a couple more general questions on what we got. The first is, were there any arguments you were surprised to see raised in the decision in addressing this case?
I won't say that I was surprised. I will say that I think Amicus argued it very well there. I think maybe it was a case of like, this is a difficult position to take. And so there were some arguments that were creative. I think the argument, the proximity of 924C and 924J, arguing in favor of sort of a cumulative punishment rather than alternatives, creative. I don't know that it was surprising. And so I think maybe it was just a position of the government and the defendant agreed, and there was a court-appointed amicus who was making the strongest arguments they could on behalf of the Second Circuit's position. So not so much surprising as notable.
Fair enough. The inverse question, is there anything that was missing or didn't come up other than potentially not addressing double jeopardy in the majority opinion or choosing to put aside double jeopardy in the majority opinion? They did address it.
Decision. I think it's the double jeopardy piece. I think it may be sort of laudable discipline on behalf of the court, or maybe it's just the desire not to get into more concurrences or dissents. But I was surprised that there was not even sort of a signaling in the court's opinion about how they might have thought about the double jeopardy issue, sort of independent of Justice Gorsuch's concurrence. And so the silence on the double jeopardy issue, I thought, was very interesting.
Fair enough. You mentioned that this seems to be sort of a quintessential framing of the breakdown of the court and their thoughts, both as they're being textualists, but also the breakdown on how you use legislative history. Is there anything new that we're getting out of the way the court broke down on this and the way the argumentation went? Or does it sort of seem to fit in and affirm the larger framework as people are looking at the court and their thought processes?
I'm sure folks smarter than me might be able to suss out something sort of new or novel. I think this is more just an interesting data point, sort of reinforcing these trends we've seen writ large at the court.
Got it. Touching on the potential implications, you had mentioned this may have impact on how prosecutors decide to charge these sorts of offenses. And Justice Gorsuch touched on it a little bit in his concurring opinion about the idea that you could, or a prosecutor could throw all the charges at a particular defendant, and then a jury could convict on all of them, and we'd be fine so long as a judge didn't approve all of those convictions. As you're looking through the practical implications of this, is that typically done? Does it seem like that would be the sort of fallout, or is it going to be you choose C or J from the very beginning and you don't sort of leave that discretion up to a jury and then potentially a judge as a prosecutor making decisions?
Yeah. So I think if I've got the question, I think, I mean, sort of before this decision, they clearly did sort of pursue the C and the J convictions. They got them all and they got the sentencing on it. I think going forward, given the court's opinion, they will, like the U.S. Attorney's offices and Maine Justice will have to pick between the two. I think it will be interesting to see how they proceed. My gut, never having been a prosecutor myself, is that if you've got sort of a case where someone has died, you're going to more likely reach for the J provision, just given its seriousness and the heightened maximums, recognizing that there's a risk that you no longer have a mandatory minimum. I don't know. I have trouble seeing many district court judges going below a mandatory minimum when the jury's convicted that somebody was sort of murdered in the context of a 924J violation.
Got it. Well, that's everything I have. Any final thoughts or pieces of summary from the case?
No, I think that's it.
Perfect. Well, thank you so much again for joining us today. We really appreciate you taking this section of your day and sharing your expertise and insight. Thanks also to our audience for joining and participating. We welcome listener feedback by email at fedsocforums@fedsoc.org. And as always, keep an eye on our website and your emails for announcements about other upcoming virtual events. With that, thank you all for joining us today. We are adjourned.
Thank you for listening to this episode of FedSoc Forums, a podcast of the Federal Society's Practice Groups. For more information about the Federal Society, the practice groups, and to become a Federal Society member, please visit our website at fedsoc.org.